Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidel. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dallas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey, for getting us on tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, let's don't worry too much about that thunder you hear outside. I think in all the years that we've been doing the radio show, we've never had a storm quite like this. The lights have flickered a little bit, but I think the studio is going to be fine. And ladies and gentlemen, we want to offer a very special welcome tonight to Crystal Clemens. She's a very dear friend of Audrey, and she's visiting Audrey. And tonight, Crystal is going to be providing our blonde joke. And yes, Crystal is also a blonde. Audrey's duties tonight are extensive on the radio show, and she'll be actually narrating or reading the text of a oral history conducted by Dr. Jean Carte, and we want to thank Audrey for doing that. That's a very difficult job to do, and she'll be doing that tonight. But I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny Cash for, again, taking us on that trip across the United States, where he visits more than 90 cities and states. And yes, he does sing that song from memory, if you ever had a chance to hear Johnny Cash perform that particular number. Emily and Mike, we want to thank both of you folks for being with us tonight, and again, for doing a lot of research for us in terms of news tonight. There are all kinds of criminal justice things going on. We have a couple long segments to play, so we won't be able to cover all the significant CJ news tonight, but we will do as much as we can. The purpose of our show is, like it always is, and I couldn't think of a better example than tonight. We're discussing news issues, events, and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to those tireless and energetic police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. We try to look inside the criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals, and tonight will be a real good example. We're going to focus on Chief August Vollmer, who was Chief of Police of the Berkeley, California Police Department for more than 30 years, and he was the founder and starter of the idea of police science college degree programs and the School of Criminology at Berkeley. By the way, Chief Vollmer didn't even have a high school diploma. An unbelievable scholar. He's called the father of police professionalism, and we'll have more about that later on tonight. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and I heard Alan Levy say it just yesterday that there are now more than 1,000 shows on Blog Talk Radio Network, and you go down through there. I'm not going to read all these people off and advertise for them, but go there yourself to be to the Blog Talk Radio Network that many of you are listening on this evening, and see all the different personalities, the news and celebrities and authors that have their own shows promoting books and covering very, very interesting topics. If you can't find something to interest you on Blog Talk Radio, you're probably not interested in anything. But they have more than 1,000 shows now. What's possible? Well, you, any interest group you're in or any other type of organization, you can have your own show. You can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And that price, imagine it, it's absolutely free. Let me say it again. You have your own show. You can sign up in about 5 minutes. It doesn't cost anything. You can broadcast to the world with, I think, pretty good audio from what people tell me. Once in a while we have some problems, but not very often, and it goes worldwide. And then about 5 minutes after the shows are over, the shows are archived, and you can play those back, download them, whatever you choose to do, pass it on to your friends, whatever. So like it says on the back of that Cheez-Its box, get your own box, well, get your own show. It is possible. And I think more and more organizations are figuring this out. They're following up on Alan Levy's tremendous discovery of developing this particular network. Tonight's show, well, we'll do what we usually do. We'll talk a little bit about some criminal justice news. We'll have a blonde joke, of course, with a guest host to give us that blonde joke, and that will be Crystal Clemens, and we'll hear from her in just a moment. But we're going to have part two of this oral history business. Oral history is a very significant research method where you can go out and sit down with a tape recorder, with an audio recorder, and ask a series of questions over somebody's career or about particular events, whatever. Come back, transcribe all that out, put some subtitles in there, and you've got yourself an article or the start of a book. And Dr. Jean Carté did a lot of these oral history interviews with people that worked with Chief August Mahmer in California and worked around him, knew him. In fact, the gentleman tonight that will be conducting the interview or hearing the interview with that Gene did was Austin McCormick. And his topic here on tonight was called Education for the Profession. That's Gene's title. And he was also on the School of Criminology faculty with and a neighbor of August Vollmer. And I think you're going to find it fascinating. The stuff that Vollmer did, I just couldn't go over all that tonight, but get his book by Dr. Jean Carté called August Vollmer, The History of Police Professionalism. And most of that book is research done by Jean Carté while he was at the School of Criminology in Berkeley, where he got his PhD, D.Crim. Yes, I forgot that. They didn't offer a PhD. They offered a D.Crim, which is one of the few places in the United States that offer a doctorate with that particular label. Well, you know what you can do. You can listen on your computer, Windows Media. You're doing that now. You can call in by phone to our website. That call-in number is during the news segment of the show. It's 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983. We can pull 5 calls at a time, and what we're able to do is everybody can talk to each other. If that happens, we haven't done that for a while, but we're going to have some multiple authors on here in the next few weeks, and we'll be doing that particular feature. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to have, for the first time in the history of the Jumbo Justice Radio Show, a guest host provide us the blonde joke, and she is a very dear friend of Audrey England, our tremendous narrator for our show, and technical and spiritual advisor, as she often says when she introduces the show. And her guest friend is Crystal Clemens. And Crystal, we thank you very much for joining us tonight, and you're going to be doing our blonde joke, so let's go ahead with it.
Professor Haley, tonight we break tradition and protocol. Because of Audrey's other major responsibilities on the show tonight, she has asked me to do the blonde joke. I will not recite a real joke, but a series of one-liners about things a real blonde would do. Thanks, Audrey, for letting me do this. Here we go. She was so blonde that she thought a quarterback was a refund. she managed to trip over my cordless phone. On the bottom of the job application, where it said, "Sign here," she wrote, "Aquarius." She sent me a fax with a stamp on it. She told me to meet her on the corner of Walk and Don't Walk. She tried to place a bag of M&Ms in alphabetical order. She put lipstick on her forehead because she wanted to make up her mind. She took a ruler to bed so she could see how long she slept. When she got an AM radio, it took her 10 months to figure out she could use it at night also. She spent 25 minutes staring at the orange juice box because it said, "Concentrate." She got stabbed in a shootout. She used to sit on the TV so she could watch the couch. When she heard that 90% of all crimes were around the home, she moved. She thinks certificate is a set of gardening tools. When she saw the sign for YMCA, she said, "Look, they've spelled Macy's wrong." She put lipstick on her forehead cause her boyfriend told her to make up her mind. She tried to drown a fish. If you offered her a penny for her thoughts, you'd get change. She got locked in a grocery store and starved to death. She took a spoon to the soup her bowl. It takes her 2 hours to watch 60 minutes. She asked for a price check at the Everything's a Dollar store. They had to burn her school down to get her out of the fourth grade.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Crystal. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Crystal Clemens, a very dear friend and a visitor to Audrey England, our regular spiritual and technical host for the show. And you'll be hearing from Audrey. Thank you, Audrey, for inviting Crystal. You'll be hearing from Audrey later on this evening in the show. And ladies and gentlemen, right now we'd like to play on a more serious note. We understand that in a few places in the United States, crime is starting to go up, and the New York Times has helped solve us for it, that for us, why this is happening. And I'll comment on that news story in just a moment. But we're going to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms public service announcement, as we do every week, in hopes that the criminals on the street will hear this announcement, because I'm sure it's directed toward them, and they'll be gangsters and street thugs and punks will turn their firearms in, and we'll have lower crime rates in the major cities around the United States.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and again, we hope that message falls on the proper ears. Well, tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a look at some of the major news stories tonight, and I thought this was interesting. It comes across in one of the higher education magazines. It gives us a daily update of what's going on, and this first story is kind of interesting. The headline reads, "Most Colleges Avoid Risk Management." The report says, here's the lead line, less than a quarter of colleges regularly assess how they could prevent or respond to threats such as criminal acts, or environmental catastrophes, and financial misconduct. And half of the colleges plan for such risks only after receiving an audit, experiencing a campus crime, or seeing the fallout from such a problem on another campus. And these are the key findings of a survey released today by United Educators, that's a higher education insurance company, and the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. And they're recommending that, of course, that these schools make a list of or documented plans on how to respond to one or various and sundry types of catastrophes on the campus. We've done shows actually about campus crime. We've had Dr. Marty Schwartz come on and comment on his recent book on sexual assault on campus. So it's not something to be minimized, but on the other hand, to have plans for virtually everything that's going to happen perhaps is not possible. Some of the comments, you can always comment to this particular publication, and some of the postings are something like this. "Oh, yes, give us more risk management bureaucracy. It works so well, and it's oh so pertinent. But I like the part the report recommends that institutions identify the major risks they face and the likelihood of those incidents. I am hoping, perhaps wishfully, that a cabinet might scale back their risk management bureaucracy according to the likelihood of identified threats. In other words, he's talking about probabilities. But I find this unlikely. We'll probably all need in the future tome-sized policies for shooting sprees, anthrax, class 4 hurricanes, 500-year floods, stock market crashes, and, oh yes, controversial guest speakers. I'll only read you the second comment. In addition to that one, it says risk management. So we sit around and play what if and then make a plan for it. I have thousands of more urgent things to take care of. Thanks anyway. I don't know if that was a college president that said that or not. But anyway, you sort of get the idea. I mean, Homeland Security, local police agencies all over the place. Everybody's making plans for things. Some of these things are more likely to happen than not. And some, I think we have plans for. People are sitting around making plans, new plans, to respond to things that are not likely to happen or about as likely as Mercury coming out of orbit and landing on your house tonight. Whoa, look out. Here's an interesting one that was linked up on the Drudge Report tonight, and it comes out of the green section of the New York Times. What better place? And this is talking about what about a nudist vacation? Not for any reasons that you could imagine unless you read the story. It's to save energy. It says here, with summer upon us, how many green vacationers' fancies will turn to the thoughts of nudism? Going without clothes on beaches and other vacation spots is commonly called naturism, a description that implies helping the planet, as some practitioners claim to be doing. Spending more time with nothing on stems waste and pollution in all sorts of ways, according to an article written by Kathy Blanchard in the Naturist Society's website. Living more hours naked each day results in a dramatic drop in my laundry, which in turn reduces my water and energy, along with my related bills. It also reduces the amount of soap I release in my case into the Puget Sound. So she must live up in the Seattle area. I'm not kidding. She also advocates naturist holidays, staying close to home wherever possible to cut down on fuel usage, but sometimes traveling to places where it's possible to leave the car behind and backpack or paddle naked into the wild. So they talk about going to France. There's a lot of people going to France to practice this on the French Atlantic coast. Green naturism is growing fast in popularity. Of the 1.5 million people who practice naturism in France, nearly a third come to Aquitaine, while foreign naturists account for more than half of the vacationers there. So if you want to take off and have a nude vacation and feel real good, what's that called, Audrey? Yes, competitive altruism. If you want to feel better than your neighbor about your ability and your desire and your actions to save the planet, then I think it's time to get nude. And the days that you can not wear clothes, every day is a savings day in that regard. Here's a story I thought was really unusual, criminal justice related in some ways, but hundreds of New York City public school teachers, they're accused of offenses ranging from simple insubordination to sexual misconduct. These people are being paid their full salaries to sit around all day playing Scrabble, surf the internet, or just staring at the wall if that's what they want to do. Can you believe this? Because their union contract makes it extremely difficult to fire them, the teachers have been banished by the school system to its rubber rooms, off-campus office space where they wait for months, even years, for their disciplinary hearings. They have 700 doing this right now. They can practice yoga, work on their novels, paint portraits of their colleagues, pretty much anything but schoolwork. They have summer vacation just like their classroom colleagues. Vacation from what? And enjoy weekends and holidays throughout the school year. You just basically sit here for 8 hours, says Orlando Ramos, who spent 7 months in a rubber room, officially known as a temporary reassignment center, in 2004 and 5. I saw several near fistfights, he said. This is my seat. I've been sitting here for 6 months, that sort of thing. I'm not going to read the rest of it, but because the teacher's salaries They're averaging about 70,000 or more per year. This is costing the New York City school system about $65 million a year. Can you absolutely believe that? The United Federation of Teacher Union Leaders says the Department of Education reached an agreement last year to try to reduce the amount of time educators spend in reassignment centers, but progress has been slow. So it sounds like if you want to write a novel or something, you got some real personal work to do, then sass out your principal or be insubordinate or something, and you're sitting pretty. You write the great American novel, and you get dismissed, and away you go, and you've been paid all the time you've been doing it. This is an important news story, and this is a subject I've been on for a long time, and that's the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission. It's a relatively new commission. Listen to that thunder, Mike. They conducted a study, and they're going to issue their binding standards for corrections agencies that will have the force of law. According to Attorney General Eric Holder, we'll have 1 year to codify anti-sexual assault procedures, and then state governors will have an additional year to signal their compliance with those standards, losing up to 5% of federal financing for corrections if they don't. They would be losing that. This is an issue that's been going on long and long. I've talked to graduate students for years about, you know, how do we stop rapes in prisons? And, you know, somebody gets sent to prison, your friend, your relative or whatever, and they end up in, you know, the prey of, you know, Mickey whoever in prison. And then, of course, what's very disheartening is that many correction staff percentage are involved in this. Women corrections officers, if you would be surprised, are involved in this as well as men. So we hope these standards get out. We hope prisons take them serious. A lot of people say, well, we can't do anything about it. Plus, it's a criminal anyway. Who cares? Well, we have to care. You know, if you're a professional in criminal justice, you know, you need to do something about this. Some other criminal justice news I think is important. We have Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is one of the most surveilled cities in the United States, one of the oldest, by the way, and they're talking about a bad idea down there, at least one commentator, and it says the town outsources its video camera surveillance to resident volunteers. So Lancaster, you can go down and volunteer to come in and watch the surveillance cameras that virtually cover every street and access to streets in the city of Lancaster. And isn't that a little bizarre? So you could have voyeurs and all kinds of people. They're trying to weed out the voyeurs, they say, and anyone who might use the tapes for blackmail or other illegal activity. But one woman comments, I can't believe it that anybody comes in and out of my front door. They're on video camera 24 hours a day. And we're starting to see a little resistance to this across this country. We've done entire shows on that, and I'm not making much progress on it, but I want to write this book called I See You, The Logic and Lunacy of Continuous and Expanding Video Surveillance. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in that, and some of the people in Lancaster are finally catching on. They don't like this. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about scientific research right now. The New York City Times reporters have conducted a study, and they found out that the number of killings in New York City go up with the temperature. Let me say that again. The number of killings in New York City go up with the temperature. So as it becomes more hot, as in other words, the summer is upon us, and we get into June, July and August particularly, homicides actually go up. In fact, crime goes up, crimes against persons. Now, just because two things vary in the same direction doesn't necessarily mean one causes the other, does it? Hot tar and diaper rash both vary in the same direction, but one doesn't cause the other. The expansion of big box discount stores in the 1960s expanded rapidly in the 1960s, and so did crime. It went up astronomically. So did crime cause the big box stores, or did the big box stores cause crime? I don't think so. But these New York Times reporters, I'll say their names, Andrew Lehrin and Al Baker, they're infatuated with this thesis, and they're saying that, I don't know, does that mean if I know that? I just figured it out. Mike, you're correct. There's a connection between climate warming, global warming, and crime. So if we can reduce the temperature on the surface of the earth, and particularly in these large cities, then what we'd be able to do is reduce crime. So it may be that easy that all we need to do is concentrate more on global warming, if we could possibly do that, and we can get the crime rate down. Now, isn't that incredible, ladies and gentlemen? I think this requires a little bit of thought. Well, you probably heard the one about it's been talked about all over the place, where the Denver police officer shows up at a McDonald's in Aurora, Colorado, and his order isn't being serviced fast enough, so he actually pulls out a gun. He gets angry at how long they're taking getting his food. So one of the officers flashed his police badge and pointed a pistol through the drive-thru window in a threatening manner. I've always wanted a student to do a research project and interview a number of drive-thru window clerks who actually provide their service late at night, some of those 24-hour drive-thru windows. I can't even imagine the things that they must see. We'll finish with this one, not too criminal justice related, but it's a violation of a city ordinance. And this is Brooksville, Florida. And what's happened down there is their city council has actually approved a dress code as part of its effort to update existing policies. The revision instructs employees to observe strict personal hygiene. Now, that's sort of counter-grain, isn't it? Yeah, because we have colleges in the United States now where they're only showering like once a week. But anyway, it includes the use of deodorant. It lists the observable lack of undergarments and exposed undergarments as unacceptable attire. You just can't do it. It also prohibits clothing with foul languages or messages on it. Anything that's a sexually provocative garment, halter tops and piercings anywhere except the ears. Trying to think where else you can do that piercing, but I don't want to get into that. And the repeat offenders can be fired. And the city council has approved this dress code 4-1. And Mayor Bernardini, he opposed the revision. He said, saying the underwear edict takes away freedom of choice. And you know what? If you want to take a global perspective on this, if you're not buying, you're not wearing, you're not washing underwear, in fact, you're saving soap, you're saving energy, and you're helping preserve our planet. So there you go. There's a green angle or an anti-green angle to virtually everything we're talking about here. Now, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to spend the remainder of time on talking about August Farmer. I'm going to let yes, Mike, I am. I'm going to let some of this be discussed by Audrey, a little prelude. These are comments that were written by Dr. Jean Carte, and I'll quickly go over again for those who don't recall from previous shows who Dr. Jean Carte is. But Jean Carte was a member of the University of Cincinnati Criminal Justice Department faculty from 1973 to 1977. I was there. I was the chair. I was the chair at the time that we hired him, and he was a very fine scholar with a doctorate in criminology from Berkeley. Well, Gene was killed in a robbery in 1977 with his wife standing right in front of him, where one of these varmints blew his head off with a double barrel shotgun. I won't go into it any farther. Gene was against the death penalty, and much of his views regard to the death penalty were developed at the School of Criminology at Berkeley. The guy that did the shooting, there was another woman accomplice, he did last time, but Arthur Roden, he took off. They didn't catch him for 4 years. He was tried in 1982. Gene was killed in 1977. And in 1982, he got life in prison. And Elaine Carte, a very fine scholar herself, who was part of this oral history project with August Vollmer, I mean, people who work with August Varmer, she testified in the trial to preserve this man's life. Well, guess what? He didn't do life. He got out in 12 years. In 1994, Arthur Oden hit the street. Again, probably went home to Toledo, Ohio. But anyway, we're going to get a little bit of introduction about August Varmer himself. He was just an incredible human being. And his idea, one of his major themes, was to professionalize the police by good service, and a second item was by using technology. In other words, by being scientific. And the idea of police science degree programs, that was Chief August Varmer's idea. He was chief of police way back early in the 20th century and was chief for 30 years. He took 1 year off from that to become chief of police in Los Angeles. It's sort of like a guest chief. And we're going to go ahead and listen to a little bit of introduction. This isn't the oral history. These are just Gene's words about that. So, Audrey, go ahead and let's hear what you have.
Introduction. The image of professional policing as we know it today is largely the creation of one man, August Varmer, who was police chief of Berkeley, California, from 1905 to 1932. Varmer was a tireless crusader for the reform of policing through technology and higher personnel standards. Under his direction, the Berkeley Department became a model of professional policing, efficient, honest, scientific. He introduced into Berkeley a patrol-wide police signal system, the first completely mobile patrol, first on bicycles, then in squad cars, modern record systems, beat analysis and modus operandi. The first scientific crime laboratory in the United States was set up in Berkeley in 1906, under the direction of a full-time forensic scientist. The first lie detector machine to be used in criminal investigation was built in the Berkeley Department in 1921. Varmer's department was best known for the caliber of its personnel. He introduced formal police training in 1908, later encouraging his men to attend classes in police administration that were taught each summer at the University of California. Eventually, he introduced psychological and intelligence testing into the recruitment process and actively recruited college students from the university. Starting around 1919, this was the beginning of Berkeley's college cops, who set the tone for the department throughout the 1920s and 30s, and came to be accepted by police leaders as the ultimate model of efficient, modern policing. Nationally, Varmer worked through such forums as the International Association of Chiefs of Police, serving as president in 1922. He served as a police consultant in cities like Kansas City, Missouri, 1929, and he directed the police study for the 1931 National Commission on Law Observance and Enforcement, better known as the Wickersham Report. He condemned the corruption and ineffectiveness that prevailed in most American police departments, and urged professionalization of the police function, removal of political influence from routine police operations, and the adoption of modern technological methods. Varmer's concept of professionalism has dominated police literature since he articulated it, and remains relatively unquestioned today. We need to explore the origins of this concept, the historical realities within which it developed, and the police department that served as its model. James Q. Wilson has characterized Varmer's professional police department as one that emphasized efficiency, law enforcement, aggressive street patrol, and honesty. Quote, traditional policing in the period when Varmer was active was the victim of political meddling and inept leadership, and the traditional policeman was haphazardly selected and poorly trained. The ideal professional policeman, on the other hand, is honest, skilled, and impartial in the face of competing political demands that are made upon him. He is trained in the technology of policing, especially in criminal identification, evidence gathering, and investigation. He avoids the overtly coercive aspects of policing whenever possible, aiming instead for the prevention of crime or confrontation through his appreciation of the psychology and sociology of crime and criminals. August Varmer was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, in 1876. His only formal education beyond the grade school level was a vocational course in bookkeeping, typing, and shorthand, that he took at the New Orleans Academy. His family moved to Berkeley, California in 1891 when Vollmer was 15. 3 years later he opened a coal and feed store with a friend, and was active in the formation of the Volunteer Fire Department. He enlisted in the Army when the Spanish-American War broke out in 1898, and was sent for a year to the Philippines, where the U.S. Army was engaged in warfare with indigenous Filipino groups following the expulsion of the Spanish. Vollmer took part in river patrols, and participated in 25 engagements with the enemy. He came to admire the organizational skills of the professional Army Corps, and frequently referred to his Army experience in later years, when discussing the strategy of police operations. After returning home, he worked as a letter carrier in Berkeley for 4 years until he was approached to run for town marshal. Police scholar Bruce Smith has referred to the position of marshal as not primarily devised for what we now know as police work. Lee, in Berkeley, the marshal was a political functionary who ran for election every 2 years, and was responsible for a loosely organized body of services. Law enforcement had been lax in the past, and Berkeley had acquired a reputation for having poor police protection. Gambling and opium dens operated with little interference from the authorities, and criminals from San Francisco and Oakland found the town an easy target. It was these conditions that prompted several leading citizens to sponsor Vollmer for the job. His backers included Friend Richardson, editor of the Daily Newspaper and later governor of California from 1922 to 26, and George Schmidt, postmaster, both important members of the Republican Party. Vollmer campaigned hard, and won election by a margin of 3-1. Vollmer entered policing during the Progressive Era, in a town that was known for its reform-minded citizens. At that time Berkeley was a town of 20,000 persons, many of whom earned their living in San Francisco or Oakland, but were alarmed by the corruption and lawlessness that prevailed there. Only 50 years before, San Francisco justice had been dominated by vigilante committees, the most organized and powerful in American history. The current police forces both there and in Oakland had reputations for corruption and inefficiency. Berkeley was an ideal setting for the introduction of an honest, efficient, technological police force. It was a small city dominated by middle-class business, professional and academic groups who supported municipal reform. Vollmer was able.
I think you begin to get a little bit of a sense of Jean Cartier's in-depth scholarship, and of course he wrote his doctoral dissertation on this subject, and I might add that he won the Richard McGee Award, and that award is given each year to the best doctoral dissertation at the University of California at Berkeley, and I might say that that's not an easy place to win any award at, neither was it an easy place to get in. So Gene left Berkeley, went to Trenton State. He worked at Trenton State College in New Jersey for 2 years, and we hired him at the University of Cincinnati, as I said, in 1973, and he was there until his untimely and tragic death in 1977. So what you're going to hear now is Audrey actually reading. You'll hear Cartier, McCormick. You're actually going to hear him interview Mr. McCormick, Austin McCormick, who was a very famous prison reformer and also a UC Berkeley educator in the School of Criminology there. So here we go, Audrey, and again, thank you very much for all your work tonight and narrating this for us.
Austin McCormick, March 16, 1972, Osborne Association, 114 East 30th Street, New York City, interviewed by Gene Cartcart. What was your personal relationship with Mr. Vollmer? McCormick, when I went to the School of Criminology at the University of California, Berkeley, as professor of criminology in 1951, I had already known of Chief Vollmer. I had met him the year before when I taught in the summer session at the School of Social Welfare. I had known him as a great and distinguished man, and now I found myself living a block away from him. I became one of his proteges almost immediately. My first experience with him was on the night my wife and I moved into the house we had rented for the summer. We had an earthquake, and the house was on the very steep side of a hill. We didn't know what to do when it shook the house 3 or 4 times, as if it would slide down the hill. Chief Vollmeren said, "What do we do?" "The street." He said, "Go back to bed. It'll all be over in a minute." This is a trivial thing, but it tests part of his greatness, that he was very reachable. I'll tell you later about the affection the little boys in the neighborhood had for him, and how he would be the judge in all the quarrels they'd bring to him. They also came to get candy, but they liked to have him pass on the things they were disputing about. An innovator for police science, McCormick, but let me go back. His first relationship with what is now the School of Criminology was when he organized courses in police science in the summer of 1916, as I recall it, at the university. In what department it was, I don't know, but probably public administration. This was the beginning of what finally became the School of Criminology, the only school in the country with that title, although other universities have departments which they could call a school or department of criminology, if they wanted to, notably Michigan State University. But it all began with police administration. It became the School of Criminology when it branched out into other phases of the crime problem, and finally the 3 parts of its curriculum were police administration or law enforcement, scientific crime detection, and the correctional curriculum, which I was brought in to establish in 1951. Kirk Police Science was Professor Kirk. McCormick, no. Dr. Paul Kirk and Edwin O'Neill, who is still there, were terrific experts in the field of what they called criminalistics. Dr. Kirk created that term as a title for crime detection by laboratory and other scientific methods. It was not merely detective, like the people in the detective stories who go around and question a lot of people, but the use of microscopic and chemical analysis, and many other scientific procedures. It was the toughest part of our curriculum, and it took longer to complete the requirements than either of the other 2 parts of the curriculum. But we always called him Chief. Chief Vollmer was known as the father of police science, and to jump ahead to one of your other questions, the thing he is most famous for is his influence on the professionalism of police work. And he didn't mean that only the man in the laboratory must be a professional, but that law enforcement itself should be a profession. We had courses there in police work on such a high level that our young graduates went out with much more training than most police chiefs in the United States. They were encouraged to go to work in departments like the Berkeley Police Department, which officials from Scotland Yard told me was the best police department among what they called the smaller cities of the United States. It was actually in the top 100 as to size, so it was not really a small city. Its police department was respected all over the world, beginning with the years when Chief Vollmer headed it. Police science to him included the people in the patrol cars. It meant the whole police process from top to bottom. Nowadays we wouldn't call police on the beat or in cars professionals, but they are working in a field in which one can reach professional rating. Chief Vollmer made several very innovative contributions at Berkeley in the early 1900s. You may have heard of them from other people. He was the first official to put police officers in patrol cars, although all he had were Model T Fords. He was the first one to install radio communication. They used the old-fashioned crystal sets. I've seen pictures of the police officers McCormick in Berkeley standing proudly by a Model T Ford, and wearing a very funny-looking type of uniform. But this was the beginning of tremendous progress in police work. There were squad cars in other parts of the country, I believe. McCormick, I probably was inaccurate when I said that. I am not too sure, though. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Chief Vollmer was the first one who did it. That is the way I seem to have heard it. But if Dean Wilson didn't say it, or John Holstrom Cart, I just thought that there were squad cars. McCormick, well, W. Wilson knew more than I did about that. He was one of Chief Vollmer's protégés. Another one was General Dean. We always called him Bill Dean. As you know, he was a Congressional Medal of Honor winner in the Korean War. Another one was Walter Gordon, who later became the head of the California Adult Authority, which is the state sentencing and parole authority. He then became Governor General of the Virgin Islands and later a federal judge. Wilson, as you know, resigned as Dean of the School of Criminology in 1960 to become head of the Chicago Police Department, and did a wonderful job of reforming and reorganizing it. Chief Vollmer also organized what I know for sure was the first Juvenile Crime Prevention Bureau. So, at the same time that he was trying to improve the methods of detecting and preventing crime by surveillance by police in cars or on foot, he was also the pioneer in the juvenile delinquency prevention field. It spread over the country pretty rapidly, but he was the first on that. Another thing on which he was the first is that he introduced England's Henry system of fingerprinting to the United States. He got the state of California to accept it, and it spread to the rest of the country. There's a period in his history about which I don't know very much, when he went to Northwestern University and established a curriculum or a division that had to do with police work and with the general subject of crime. He was there for several years. So he was an innovator, and was also in on some of the early innovations which perhaps other people started. Cut your first real contact with Vollmer, then, was when you went on the faculty. He was already retired. McCormick, yes, he'd been retired for a long time. I arrived in 1951. His active career ended in the 1930s, as I recall. Cut, but he was very much interested in the School of Criminology. McCormick, yes. It was his baby. But didn't he come down there an awful lot? It wasn't he, as if he was always messing with it. McCormick, we went to him for advice, went to him for encouragement, went to him, just because he was such a wonderful person to talk to be with. When there were early faculty meetings, he wasn't invited to those meetings, necessarily, you know. At the time when I joined the faculty, he was already beginning to have terrible arthritis and suffering greatly from it. And he later developed Parkinson's disease. I would like to speak about that a little more later. That was toward the end of my stay, and just before his death. But when my wife and I first arrived, I'd forgotten that one of the things he did was to take us in his car, or perhaps I drove, all over Berkeley's Hugh Park system. There was a canyon up back of Grizzly Peak, where you went down the other slope, and were in the huge canyon, and that in the slope of the ridge were the city park system. He was very proud of it. He'd been a promoter of the parks years before. It was one of his great interests. You drove, or he drove. Well, I know that he was active at that time. I think he probably drove. Yes, I am quite sure he did. I was thinking that he was already beginning to be crippled with arthritis. Didn't he come regularly to the faculty meetings? But he was seeing all of us school faculty members all the time. We'd drop in on him, just to see him, and talk with him, whether we had anything to ask his advice on or not. He was always very closely in touch. You were in corrections, no, it was the correctional part of the whole curriculum. During the 4 months after Dean Wilson went to Chicago, I was the acting dean. I was the advisor to all the graduate students, also to those students who were in the correctional curriculum, and to those students in criminology. I had an overall involvement in the school. It was a small faculty, and we were all experts in fields. The only faculty members were Kirk, O'Neill, yourself, Mr. Wilson Drive. Kelly, the psychiatrist, was there. John Holstrom, Clixif of Berkeley Police Department, was part-time. We had two or three other people who were part-time faculty members. So Vollmer had contact with, yes, he was very close to all of us. Cart, including Drive. Kelly. McCormick, yes. Whenever Dean Wilson thought of doing anything new, I have no doubt he talked it over with Chief Vollmer. even bringing me out there he probably talked that over. And Vollmer, with his primary interest in police work and law enforcement, would unquestionably have leaped at the idea of introducing correctional courses to. Now Dr. Kelly, don't you forget, came on the scene, just before I did, and his courses cut across all the others, because everybody had to take at least one of his courses, even the criminalistic students. He not only was a psychiatrist, he had complete credentials as a psychologist. So he had everybody. Even the man who was going to go right out and get a job in the sheriff's office as a police officer had to take some of the courses in psychiatry. So Vollmer was in on this too. I know they never made that step forward without talking to him. That was chiefly because of Dean Wilson. He'd known him longer than anybody else on the faculty, and respected his opinion. It wasn't he that Vollmer would get angry if he wasn't he consulted Cart. He had that kind of influence on the way the curriculum went. McCormack, that's right. And he could see way ahead. I'll wager that on every single thing that finally developed, from summer courses in police work to a full-fledged school of criminology, he was consulted at either step. Vollmer's approach to the criminal Cart Vollmer, of course, was always interested in the individual criminal. His last major book was The Criminal. McCormack he had a lot of interest too in the psychiatric, or the emotional phases of crime. You can see that in his book. He's got quite a bit in there. The only thing I ever disagreed with him on is that he thought perhaps we should adopt what was then called the British system of giving heroin users free heroin. He just said that tentatively. He wasn't sure, but he knew that efforts to treat the heroin problem were failing. It was nowhere near as widespread then as it is now. So he thought possibly that we should try the English system. But the English system was never really a system. It was simply that British physicians could treat an addict without being clobbered. But in this country, the Bureau of Narcotics under Harry Anslinger would go after a physician and try to revoke his license if they found he was prescribing heroin. Cartso Vollmer didn't agree with Anslinger's approach to controlling crime, controlling narcotic addiction. McCormack he thought it was a failure, and I think he was wise enough to think in terms of the heroin user as a sick person, although I don't recall he ever said that. But I think you hit it. He was certain the answer to crime of all types is not just heavier sentences. He would certainly believe that the more arrests you can make the better, but then after they were arrested and convicted, he was never one to keep piling on the heavy sentences. Cart was this disagreement with the failure to handle narcotic crimes a philosophical disagreement, that he just disagreed with that approach, or was it because it had failed? In other words, he was just a man who was a pragmatist. McCormack I think in its mind it was that the problem did not belong in the field the police, courts, punishment field. But in those days it was really a minor problem compared with what it is today. I've been dealing with it since 1929, and you know it's only in recent years that it's reached such colossal proportions and has spread into a lower age bracket. It was probably characteristic of him that he believed in the efficiency of the arrest, trial and court procedure, but he was never interested in just punishing everybody heavily. He would always be thinking of ways in which you could treat the offender, or if you had to sentence him to prison, or put him on probation or parole, he would want to do everything possible to straighten him out. He was a real correctional reformer too. Cart, but that distinction some people are just philosophically opposed to certain types of treatment of offenders. And other people realize that, if we treat offenders harshly it just fails. Vollmer was more concerned in trying to keep the criminal justice system as efficient as possible, rather than just being philosophically opposed. McCormack he was not punitive. No, and I am in the same state of mind. I wish it were possible to arrest everybody that does anything halfway serious, but then dispose of the case wisely, and with a great variety of dispositions. There are some things, like running through red lights repeatedly, and then tearing up your violation tickets, that call for punishment. I would be willing to punish anybody who does that. But if he is a burglar, and he was brought up in a neighborhood where everyone was living by thieving, then someone should just try to get him straightened out by teaching him a trade, so that he can earn a living. And I know Chief was that way. If he had happened to land in the correctional field, if he had been a prison warden, say, at this McCormick time, he would have been just as far ahead in his thinking prisons, operation of prison.
Well, we're not going to be able to hear all of that, but you can go ahead and go back on the website. But you can go to archive.org and type in Gene Carte, that's Gene, G-E-N-E-C-A-R-T-E. Audrey pronounced his name in the oral history recitation as Cart, and many people did call him that. I've had him at my house, and he'll pick up the phone and call somebody, and he called somebody in West Virginia and said, "This is Eddie Cart." But just as many people knew him in the field as Dr. Gene Carte, and that was a name that he was most recognized by. And I think it's important to mention in this that with a few minutes we have left that what August Vollmer did way back in, you know, we're talking the first decade of the 20th century, the early 1900s, he saw criminal justice as a system. The police courts, institutional and community corrections and juvenile justice and the prison should all work together. And that was kind of a novel idea. He hired college graduates in the first portion of the 20th century in 1905, 1906. This is a time when about 5 or 6% of the American population graduated from high school, and he was hiring college graduates on the police department. He was very strict about discipline. He was as innovative as you can be. He was a thinking person, and he saw that the professionalization of the police was based on maintaining their integrity and introducing technology, some of the things you saw there, patrol car, lie detector, et cetera, into police work. And he certainly was a tribute to the motto of, as a police officer, you should just keep learning throughout your career. One of his famous students was O.W. Wilson, who wrote the first police administration textbook. And Wilson was a protege of August Vollmer, and again, as I mentioned in the interview, that he was also superintendent of the Chicago Police. He had been the Wichita, Kansas Police Chief, I think, and other places. So he was a real innovator also. He did mention in there the only other school, McCormick mentioned Michigan State University, and Michigan State University Chief Art Bramstetter walked up on the campus up there in Michigan State in 1936 and said, "Let's have some college courses for cops." And, of course, that's the place that I went in 1970, and that was a marvelous place to be. They took 30 people from all over the world, and my Lord, people were sorry when that year ended. Well, that's it for tonight. That was an oral history and study of August Vollmer, and we hope you join us next week, and we'll look at the have a look at the show billing and see what we're going to be covering, and I'm sure we'll be meeting again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.